Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have here back on the show once again, May Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at University of Illinois. She's a scientist who studies insects. And occasionally, particularly during the time when the insects are most obviously active, you heard some there throwing their books around. She comes by and we talk about them. And the way I start out the program is I always say, now look, I know that sometimes insects can be pests, and you maybe want to get rid of them. But we have somebody else for that. That's not what this show is about. This show is about trying to appreciate insects for the many interesting and varied ways they go about living their lives. So if you have questions about insects, we will take them. If there's something that you have seen and you're interested in trying to find out what it is, give us the best description that you can, and May will see if she can do an identification. And I've seen her do that many times, even though we can't see what it is we're talking about. So she'll give you her best shot. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. It's nice to have you here.
Always a pleasure. And I should say, in the interest of what fair and balanced broadcasting, you've also seen me not get the right answer sometimes.
Well, that's true. what we're asking you to do is difficult because you are just relying on someone's description of something. But, we have an auto mechanic who does that, and we have doctors who do that. It's diagnosis over the phone, and I always say, we can't do that, but we do that anyway. So that's kind of what we're doing.
And I think I have something of a greater challenge than the auto mechanics, because I don't know how many makes of cars there are, but I don't think there are 900,000 different cars and there are 900,000 different insects. So.
Oh, they're all kind of the same, though, aren't they, really? They all have the same number of legs?
Not necessarily.
So. No?
Well, there's some legless ones. I mean, in theory, they have all six. But
okay. Now, all of these years, I'm thinking the one sure thing you could say about an insect was that they have six legs. Now you're telling me that that's right.
Well, I guess, there's... It's not a bad generalization, as generalizations go.
I see. All right. Well, we have someone to talk with already. Let's do that. Someone here on the cell phone on line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I live out in the country, and I have a wonderful population of praying mantises that have showed up in my yard, which is wonderful because they eat all the flies. This last year, they made some egg cases on my bushes around my house. And so this spring, I went out to kind of look to see if I could see little baby praying mantises. And some of them looked kind of dried out, like maybe they weren't going to hatch. Nothing seemed to happen with them. Should I have protected them some way, taken them in the garage over the winter, or is there something that I can do to help them? I know some of them did hatch because I saw a really nice big guy get left.
Well, that's kind of a two-edged sword because that egg case that you mentioned is sort of most people recognize is really an amazing construct. It's a foamy mass that hardened. It's kind of like blown-in insulation, basically, is what the female produces with some glands that accompany the glandular secretions accompany the eggs. So it's this hard foam into which are packed the eggs. And the foam helps maintain the temperature through the cold winter months. Now, the disadvantage, if you bring them inside, is that odds are good they'll hatch in March when you'll be stuck with 200 or 300 baby mantises and nothing for them to eat except each other. So the best you can hope for with that particular outcome is one very large, well-nourished mantid, guilty of fratricide or whatever you call it when you eat all your siblings, siblicide. So the timing is a lot better if you just leave them out in nature because as the weather warms up, the prey species become abundant at the same time that the eggs will hatch. It's a risky business leaving your eggs lying around in the environment. So all kinds of things could have happened. There are creatures that eat eggs, for example, or parasitize eggs. So, yes, you probably could have saved a few mantids by bringing them in, but then you run the risk of not being able to care for them when they hatch. And I guess you have, with the legal precedent, res ipsa loquitur, the thing speaks for itself. They must be doing okay since you got the Chinese mantids. Is by big, you mean like 4 or 5 inches?
Well, this guy was, about 4 inches.
Uh-huh. Yeah, green, that's your classic Chinese mantis, which was, these were introduced in the late 19th century to do exactly what you say, to eat all the flies and other pests in the garden. So probably they're all right on their own, unless you have a, I don't know, overwhelming maternal instinct and like to feed 200 hungry mouths. It's very hard to raise mantids. They eat their own weight in a day, so.
Wow. Well, there was about a half a dozen different cases, and one of them was right next to the back door, so it was real easy to watch, and it didn't seem like it was doing anything. So when it got further into the summer, and I figured if they were going to hatch, they would have hatched, I opened it up, and like it looked like the little black grains of rice, only much smaller than grains of rice, and I thought, oh, these guys didn't hatch. So then I got kind of depressed.
Well, insects generally have pretty low rates of survival, which is why they reproduce so extravagantly. So, if one female lays 200 eggs, one female can lay several of those so-called oothiki egg cases. So just one has to make it, and she's more than replaced herself.
So I shouldn't worry too much about the guys that didn't make it.
No, I think they're probably doing all right.
Okay, great.
Thanks for caring.
Thank you so very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Yes,
bye-bye.
On behalf of all the other mantids in the world, thanks for caring. Lovington is our next caller here, line number two. Hello.
I got some kind of a thing that looks like a wasp or a giant mosquito, probably about an inch long, amber, pretty hard-shelled right now. I just wonder, I don't see them very often, but I just wondered what it was.
No, it's kind of brownish?
Yeah, I'd call it more or less kind of an glow, kind of a translucent amber to maybe brown where the body parts are thicker.
And it looks like some sort of like giant mosquito from a science fiction film or something, like overgrown mosquito?
Yeah, I'd say its appendages are just a little thicker than like a wasp.
Oh, thicker than a wasp. That's interesting. Because usually when people see something that looks like, a terrifyingly oversized mosquito, what they're seeing is something called a crane fly, which is completely harmless. These are, as maggots, they're relatives of mosquitoes, but they grow to be actually an inch or more in length, and they live in their immature stages as maggots in sort of muck. Is this near any source of moisture, like a creek or a pond or anything like that?
Not particularly. I really don't know. I've for some reason, they seem to like to fly inside of the cab of my truck every once in a while. They don't really, the first time it happened,
it's a little unsettling.
Yeah. I kind of got excited, but I don't know. They don't. And I actually, that's kind of interesting that you said around muck, because I have a pile of old manure that has a bunch of
perfect.
Great big, they don't look so much like maggots as grubs, but they're in
yep.
there.
I bet that's what you got is crane flies. These things look, they're so big that they don't look like your typical maggots, and they have a few more features. There are some fly maggots that just look like sort of undistinguished blobs without heads or legs or eyes or any sort of features to distinguish them in a lineup. But the crane flies maggots, you can tell, have a head end and a tail end, and they have ridges on them, and they like decaying muck and mire. So it's not unlikely that what you've got in the cab of your truck are crane flies, but they won't do you any harm. So that's
the adult feed, or is it one of those things where they just pretty much reproduce?
There are some crane flies, actually, that makes them even scarier. They have like a beak, a long mouth parts that make it look like they're really well designed for sucking your blood, but in reality, they just suck nectar. But most crane flies, you can't see their mouth parts, and they may take a nectar meal now and then, but they're not of concern, really, to people, other than the fact that they would make good extras in a science fiction film about radiation causing things to grow giant. So.
Can I ask another question?
Sure.
Well, this kind of this might violate the rules of the show, but is there any natural predator for Japanese beetles?
Well, that's all right. Natural predator. That's okay. That's okay. Well, the Japanese beetles are subject to some diseases, and in fact, there's a disease called milky spore, which is a bacterial disease, and it lives in the soil, and it turns the immature stages of Japanese beetles, which are grubs that feed on grass roots, into pulpy goo. So that's, I think, in the Japanese beetle lexicon, that would be considered an enemy. There are some birds that'll eat them. They don't do a particularly comprehensive job, as you might have noticed. Among other things, I think those spiny legs might get caught in throats and make them less appetizing.
Sure.
But they don't have a large contingent of insect natural enemies. Whatever else you think about insects, they really are allies in the sense that the worst enemies of most insects are other insects. There are parasitic wasps that lay their eggs inside the bodies of other insects. And the reason that Japanese beetles don't have a large contingent of these kin that are deadly kin, I guess, is that they came over here in around 1916 from Japan and left behind their associated natural enemies. So that's one reason they've made it this far west in a relatively short period of time, and why they're so abundant is that they basically don't have a lot of natural enemies, and those few that they do have, they can overwhelm easily by their prodigious feats of reproduction.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Mae Barenbaum. She's an entomologist, a scientist who studies insects here at the University of Illinois. She, in fact, is head of the Department of Entomology, and every once in a while is here on the program when we talk about insects. And again, we sort of caution people, well, save your extermination questions for when Phil Nixon comes by. That's his specialty. When Mae is here, we just try to appreciate insects if we can, coexist, and enjoy them for the many interesting forms they take. And if you have something that you've seen and you can give us a description, maybe, Mae, we'll tell you what it is. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
I do have a car story, mm-hmm. an entomological car story.
Yes.
That just shows you how valuable an entomology education can be. I was driving on High Cross Road outside of Urbana, and an enormous wasp landed on, you know, it was flying in the car, landed on my shoulder, like well over an inch long. And that was really startling, and I kind of managed to get a sidelong glance at it and instantly recognized it as something called a pigeon tremex. I mean, it was this big, you know, inch and a half. And I didn't run off the road or swerve into oncoming traffic because I knew that pigeon tremexes are sawflies rather than true wasps, and they don't sting, and they breed in rotting lumber. And I avoided an accident because I knew some entomology. So that's my
object. Another example of how valuable entomology can be in your daily life.
It can save your life.
Entomology, ladies and gentlemen, it's not to be taken lightly. We had a caller off the air, and I don't know if this is the kind of activity we wanted to condone, but we had a caller off the air who said their son wanted to collect some lightning bugs in a jar and wanted to know, what do they eat?
Well, the adults, the ones that flash, don't really eat much of anything, which is why they don't live very long, among other reasons, when you put them in a jar. The immature stages will feed on soft-bodied slugs and snails and the like, the sort of soft-bodied invertebrate life. Adults, if they do occasionally feed, would be on the same sort of prey, but a lot of species, as far as anyone knows, they don't really eat much of anything.
Mm-hmm. So they're, again, like a lot of adult insects, once you get to that point, you only have one purpose, and that is to reproduce.
They really have it down, sort of niche marketing here. It's like, it's their job is sex and reproduction, and that's all they do, and they do it very well.
All right. We'll talk to someone here in St. Joe on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. We have a lot of earwigs in our house, and I was wondering if they can hurt you.
Oh, I'm sorry? Can they hurt you?
Can they hurt you?
Yeah.
Well, that's a popular misconception. In fact, the whole name earwig people think it means they crawl in your ear and give you a hard time, but in reality, they don't crawl in your ear. They're called earwigs because their hind wing, which you can't really see, they have two little short brown wings. Well, most of them are brown anyway. And underneath is a little a membranous wing that's shape of an ear, but it folds and tucks up under that hard wing cover. But people are afraid of those pincher-like things at the tail end. And the pincher-like things, which are bigger in the male than in the female, are basically used by the earwigs when they mate. So unless they find you really attractive, which is probably not going to happen, they don't. I don't know anyone personally who's ever been pinched by an earwig. I won't say it's impossible, but it's incredibly unlikely. The males will grab the females with these things. That's what they're basically built for. And earwigs do have some endearing traits. The females take care of the young. I mean, not that many insects have that maternal instinct. A lot of them just, you know, sort of when it comes to eggs, lay them and leave them is their philosophy. But the mommy earwig will take care of the babies until they're big enough to take care of themselves. It's kind of a mixed bag. Sometimes they eat other insects, so they're the good guys in a garden, and sometimes they'll actually eat grain and other plant material, so they're not such good guys. But I know it looks scary, and they wave these things at you, but I don't know of anyone who has experienced lasting damage from an earwig. Anyone out there can attest otherwise, happy to hear from them, but maybe they just, I don't know, was an earwig looking for love in all the wrong places or something. I don't know.
So does that answer your question?
Yeah, my friend Robin would like to ask a question.
Sure thing.
Okay. I was wondering, is that myth about earwigs, you know, they go inside you and try and control you. Is that myth really real?
No. I don't know of anybody who, I don't know how they would control you. I mean, I have to say it is possible for insects to get in your ears. And
I know. I feel, it felt like some have been crawling up my ears before.
Yeah, it's really creepy. Sometimes entomologists in particular suffer from this because what they do is they shine a light at night and put up a big white sheet because they like to collect insects that come to light. And it's pretty dangerous when you're out there and the insects are all flying around. And I have a couple of colleagues who've ended up in the emergency room with bugs in their ears. Although there's one interesting study that was published in a medical journal. One poor patient showed up in the emergency room with a cockroach in each ear. So the physician used that as a way to do an experiment to compare two different ways to remove insects from your ears. One is to a shot of lidocaine, which basically paralyzes the insect, and the other is just sort of wash it out with petroleum. What's it called? I guess not petroleum. Mineral oil. So I feel really sorry for that guy. But I'm told by my friends who've had insects in their ears that it's really uncomfortable, and you can hear them sort of scratching, and it's not at all pleasant. Those pincher things on an earwig can pinch you, but it's unlikely that it will break the skin. They certainly don't spread diseases, and they, as far as I know, aren't capable of mind control. So you don't really have to worry about, unless you, like, I don't know, put your head right down next to them and bait your ear. I don't think they're going to want to go in there.
Okay.
So does that make you feel a little more comfortable around earwigs?
What?
Does that make you feel happier about earwigs?
Okay,
good.
All right, thank you. You do not have to worry about earwigs crawling in your ear or biting you. Find other stuff to worry about.
There's lots more things that are more likely to happen to you.
All right, well, let's go on here. We have a caller in Normal, and this would be our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm standing outside looking at these. They appear to be a long, narrow bee. And they have yellow stripes on their back and glossy wings, and they're living in the ground in loose dirt with an entry hole about the size of your thumb. I don't know what they are, but they're just swarming around my front yard here.
Oh, that's actually, you gave a very good description of something called a sweat bee.
A sweat bee? Well, it's long. It's like an inch long.
Oh, wait a minute. An inch long?
So. Yeah, and it's got a black abdomen with yellow stripes.
Okay.
Across
it looks more waspy than bee-like, right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
That's a cicada killer.
Yeah,
and those are pretty hefty, right? I mean, this is actually the biggest wasp in the east of the Mississippi.
They're very big,
yep.
And they've got transparent wings.
Yep, that's a cicada killer. And they're very busy this time of year because, as you may have noticed, the cicadas are out. And when the cicadas are out, the cicada killers are out. This is you've described it really well. What this wasp does is it tunnels into the ground, usually like sandy soil. And so they will dig themselves a nest and lay eggs in the nest, and then they'll go out in search of cicadas. So when the cicadas sing, they find the cicadas, sting them, paralyze them, drag them. And it's not an easy thing to do. You know how big cicadas are. So these wasps have to fly carrying something that weighs possibly more than they do. Down to the ground. Yeah, it's really an impressive feat. Drag this thing underground, and then they'll lay the egg so that when the grub hatches, it can eat the still living but paralyzed cicada.
Oh, my Lord. Does it go away when the cicadas go away?
Yeah, this is their time. This is when they're active. And then when the cicada season is over, the cicada killer season's over, too.
Oh, my goodness. Do they sting human beings?
No, they are. Again, I suppose it's physically possible, but again, you'd have to, grab them in your hand and insert their mothers or something and taunt them. And even so, it's so unlikely. If you just leave them alone, they'll leave you alone. A lot of people are terrified by these guys because they're huge.
I didn't want the grandchildren around them. I didn't know what they were.
No, your grandchildren are probably more threatened by stray dogs than they are by cicada killers.
So. And so this they'll just leave their nest then when the cicadas are gone, or what? What do they do when the cicadas are gone? Do they stay here or go away or what?
Well, they're always around. They hibernate, or they spend the winter underground as pupae, you know, that intermediate stage between larva and or grub and adult. And then they come out when the cicadas come out again. So.
But the cicadas only come out in... What?
In July and August, yeah. That's
every year in July and August?
Well, there's two different kinds of cicadas.
Yeah.
These, what are out now, are called the dog day cicadas or harvest flies. They're not really flies, but they're called harvest flies. And they come out every year around this time. They're a little early, I think, for this year. It's been a strange summer. And they sing and then go about their business, and they take one or 2 years to develop on the roots of trees. The other ones that got so much publicity earlier this year are called periodical cicadas.
Uh-huh.
And they're the ones that spend 13 or 17 years mathematically precisely underground, although some of them can't count very well and they come out a little bit early.
Well, I've never seen these before, and I've been here 5 years.
The cicada killers?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a great thing because...
I do too.
It means that some area that was disturbed where you are living is becoming less disturbed because they're actually pretty adaptable. You can find them on campus, so they're not like really reclusive, but they are a really spectacular example of how and what amazing ways insects can make a living.
So I shouldn't be concerned that they're dangerous for the kids to be around.
Unless your kids do cicada imitations or something.
Yeah, okay.
It might attract them. But
they haven't tried that yet.
Yeah. If you're ever out and you hear a cicada, have you ever heard a cicada sort of
in
the middle of a song just kind of trail off?
Yeah.
Well, that's probably one that got nailed by a cicada killer. So.
Well, for heaven's sake. Well, now, the cicadas are around the trees, and these are out on the front lawn where there are no trees.
Right, which makes it all the more impressive that they drag this inert and enormous body for such a long distance.
Oh, my heavenly days. Well, why don't they have their nest near where the cicadas are?
I think a large part is, and this is just speculation on my part, is that it's hard to dig. And it's a lot easier to dig sandy soil, particularly if you have to excavate a lot, because they are big. And their grubs, you know, they have to make room for cicadas. So it's like,
Yeah, they are large mounds.
Yeah, man, if you were, it's basically the equivalent of, digging something, burying something that's your size.
Yeah.
Means digging a big hole in the ground. Or, yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, sure. Thanks for asking.
It reads my mind. I've been awfully worried about what to do about them, and I guess I'll just leave them alone.
Well, we have them between Morrow Hall and the Medical Sciences Building, and as far as I know, they haven't affected any University of Illinois students. Although, you know, we're not the typical, I guess, you know, we like having insects around. So.
But okay, so just leave
it seems
them
okay.
Alone
yeah, leave them alone, and they'll go about their business, and it's really fun to watch.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well,
thank
you.
For the call.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here of this hour of Focus 580 with Mae Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I, and occasionally here is on the program we talk about insects. Again, I try to tell people not so much extermination matters, but appreciation if we can. And coexistence, that's always a big thing. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next up is a caller in Indiana, line two. Hello.
Hello. Two questions. One, I started out, my major was going to be entomology, but along the line, physics and math grabbed me, then eventually philosophy. But anyway, I've kept up with this in a light way. I was just wondering what the thing is now that's being studied, if there is one particular buzzword out there now. And secondly, I was wondering, I've noticed over the past couple summers, the population of certain insects are diminished, and I didn't know, you know, don't know all the reasons for it, but the children in the family come to me and ask these kinds of questions. I wondered if there's any particular markers that you look for in terms of it would have something to do with the environment, problems with the poisons and things.
Thanks. There are two questions. And the first, what's the buzzword? I like that term because it's quite applicable right now. One very big thing in entomology, as in most of the life sciences, is what's called genomics. And that's the study of genomes. And a genome is the sum total of all the genes, all the DNA in an organism. And we now have ways of basically inventorying entire genomes, sequencing the DNA. The DNA contains the genetic instructions for assembling and maintaining an organism. So very large and expensive projects, although the price is going down. So genomics kind of began with small genomes, with organisms that don't have many genes, like a lot of microbes were sequenced. And, of course, a big priority early on was sequencing the human genome, and that's been completed. The first insect genome was the fruit fly, the workhorse of genetics, high school genetics and college genetics labs, Drosophila melanogaster. And that was sequenced in the year 2000. And it was very interesting. People this relative size of the human genome in relation to other organisms was kind of eye-opening. You know, Drosophila has maybe 13,000-14,000 genes in it, and we think we're way more complicated than fruit fly, but we only have maybe 36,000 or so genes. People are still trying to count them up. So it's been very, very instructive comparing the genomes of different organisms to figure out how the organisms differ and how they're similar. I mean, everybody uses DNA, so there are all kinds of commonalities. But one advantage of studying insect genomes is you want to find genes that are unique to insects so that if you knock them out, you can selectively control insect pests without hurting other organisms. So I say buzzwords because right here at the University of Illinois, are two entomologists that are kind of at the forefront of the most recent insect genome sequencing project, and that's the honeybee, Apis mellifera, the one that makes honey and pollinates all our plants. And so my colleagues Gene Robinson and Hugh Robertson are in charge of this big genome project, which is almost complete, and pretty soon we'll know all the genes that are in a honeybee and what makes a honeybee tick. And that's really interesting because, unlike most insects, honeybees have social behavior like we humans do. So there's all kinds of possibilities for figuring out whether there are genes for behavior or whether everything is learned. So that's a big, big push now. And you asked about environmental. How do we know whether insect populations are in decline because of things that are happening in the environment? kind of depends. The insects we know about that are in decline are the ones that people tend to care about. So there are some reasonably good records of declines in some of the big spectacular giant silk moths, like Luna moths and Cecropia moths, the ones that are, you know, 4 or 5 inches across and really noticeable. And collectors have admired these for a long time, so they go out and notice it's getting harder and harder to collect them. And the thought about, well, there are a lot of problems. You know, if you feed on trees and there are fewer trees, then that's always going to be a challenge. But it, a unique problem that might be affecting the giant silk moths is that at the turn of the century, some parasitic flies were released to control gypsy moth, and it turns out these parasitic flies have hundreds of other hosts, including these giant silk moths, and they may be basically maybe easier for them to attack the giant silk moths, and that might contribute to their decline. Nobody's exactly sure about that. Another group of insects that have a lot of advocates are the aquatic insects that fly fishermen rely on as models for their fly tying and for sort of matching the hatch when they go fly fishing. And it turns out that the three groups of insects that live as in their immature stages in the water, the mayflies, the stoneflies, and the caddisflies, call it Phemeroptera, Plecoptera, and Trichoptera, the EPTs, are very sensitive to pollution. And areas that are polluted have vastly different insect communities. So it's clear that human pollution affects the composition of stream insects communities. And there's people that are concerned about that. And when you reclaim the streams, you can restore the sort of healthier community composition. Of course, there's always an insect that take advantage of whatever situation. There's a group of aquatic insects called the chironomid larvae, the midge larvae, and they love pollution. I mean, there's certain species that just love pollution. They can live in there's one place in southern Illinois called Bradley's Acid Pit. You know, and it's got a pH that's like, you know, lower than vinegar, and these guys thrive. They live in fact, the immature stages. One species is red in appearance because it has hemoglobin, the same oxygen-carrying pigment that we have in our blood, because they live in water that has so little oxygen that they need a little extra push to get enough oxygen out of the water. So they're great. The more of these chironomids you have, the more polluted the stream is. So it's not that we're eliminating all insects. It's just we're sort of tipping the balance in favor of the guys who really like sludge and garbage and acid and other undesirable things. So is that a way more than you wanted to know?
Well, the caller rang off. Oh. I'd say it was a pretty good answer to the question. We'll just keep on going here. We'll go next back to some local folks, and I believe next is Champagne and line number one. Hello.
My question is about cicadas. Around July 1st, we thought we heard some, and we did some research and heard that the 17-year ones weren't around here. So my question is, are they ever around, and how about July 1st?
Well, that's why I was saying earlier that it seems like the so-called dog day cicadas, the harvest flies, usually show up in August. They seem to me to be early this year. You can tell the difference between the periodical cicadas and the sort of annual cicadas by their appearance. The periodical cicadas are a little smaller, and they also tend to be sort of bluish and oranges. I've in the past referred to them as Illini-colored insects. And the dog day cicadas are a little drabber. They're kind of brownish and greenish mottled in color. It's also said that the periodical cicadas, of which there are 6 species, but you can only tell them apart really by their calls, have a little black W on their wings. And it's supposed to foretell war. I don't know, I guess you can think of some other word that starts with W that they might be associated with. But so that marking on the wing and the color and the size are all indicators of indications that distinguish the periodical cicadas, which tend to come out in May and June from the dog day cicadas. We hear, are you calling from Urbana? Is that
I
right?
I think it was calling from Champaign.
Champaign, well, that's the same as far as cicadas are concerned. We're not within the range of any 17-year cicadas, but we occasionally do spill over into the range of a 13-year cycling species. And I'm pretty sure the last emergence, there's a lot of them in Sangamon County, I think was 19 98. So if you add 13 to that, I guess 2011, we will be enjoying an emergence of periodical cicadas. But it won't be of the magnitude of the one that just hit the East Coast. That's a 17-year species, and it's a population called Brood 10 that just happens to be a huge population. It covers many, many states, and its clock is set on a different time scale. So there are lots of different populations that start their 17 or 13-year cycles on different sort of starting years. So wait for 2011, I guess.
Yeah, but again, for us, there are cicadas that come out every year.
Right.
Same ones.
Every year you can count on them. They're the green and brown ones and not the more brightly colored ones.
And you think that their emergence is just a little bit on the early side this year?
That's my impression. I usually look for them late July, and they were, as the caller said, they were here in early July. Hmm. So. Fireflies were early this year, too. It's much harder to predict the insects than predicting the weather, I guess, because a lot of insect emergences depend on the weather. So you've got a series of probabilities.
All right. Well, let's talk with another champagne caller. This will be line 3. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
I have a question about bumblebees. We like bumblebees at our house, but we've recently found a nest that's underneath the stairs leading up to our backyard deck, and we have toddlers around, and I tried to just disturb them enough that they might leave and build a nest elsewhere by digging around the area, and they swarmed up quite a bit, but they never left. And we're wondering, what's a good way to have them leave their nest without having to spray and kill them all? And I'll just hang up and listen. Thanks.
That's a tough one. I'm actually not sure how you can convince them to move except by frequent disturbance, because they will move if they're frequently disturbed. But the downside of frequently disturbing them is that you irritate them and run the risk of getting stung. And bumblebees, which, like many truly social insects, eusocial insects, will protect their nest, and that's why they do sting. They have this capacity to sting because that's their job, is to prevent you from disturbing their nest. I do have a colleague at the University of Illinois named Sydney Cameron, who has devoted her life to the study of bumblebees, so she might, I can ask her if you want to maybe send me an email or something. My email is, I can say that on the air.
Yeah, sure.
Is maybe, maybe, at uiuc.edu. And I can ask her if she might know a gentle way to persuade them to relocate, because they take advantage of natural cavities like abandoned mouse nests and the like. So those features are not uniformly distributed throughout the environment. So there may be something about your back deck or front porch that was sort of like a prefab home for them that they moved right into. So it might be a little hard for them just to pick up and find another place so quickly.
Hmm. Will anybody overwinter there, and would you expect them to be back again next year, or will they all go off and find some different place next year?
They vary, but the queens do overwinter. The fertilized queens overwinter. Some of them will overwinter in the nest. I'm not sure all do. Some might overwinter in neighboring woods or under litter and the like. So there is that risk that they'll, it's like coming back to their summer home or something in which they have a substantial investment. So, I can certainly ask Dr. Cameron if she knows of ways that they can be persuaded to move elsewhere.
All right. Let's go to Chicago. Line 4. Hello.
Hi. I thought your discussion of genomics was really interesting. And there was a joke several years back that the only life that would survive a nuclear attack would be cockroaches and Cher. And I'm assuming the insect part of that joke is true, and I wondered why, or is it true at all?
Actually, I'm glad you asked that question. I wrote an entire article about this once, because I love these things that people know about insects, and the vast majority of things that everybody knows about insects aren't true, like mantids, have to eat the males before they'll mate kind of thing. Well, there may be a germ of truth, and that legend about cockroaches surviving a nuclear war goes back to the very early days of atomic testing. And there were a few studies that examined insect resistance to radiation, because Actually, these studies were funded by the Atomic Energy Commission because they had all this nuclear material, and they wanted, after the war was over, you know, World War II, they didn't have anything to do with this stuff, so they wanted to encourage research with atomic radiation. So a lot of people just blasted all kinds of insects to see if you could control them with radiation. Sort of ignoring the...
And they got really big.
And then they made these movies.
Yeah.
No, and it turns out that that there are some species of cockroaches are fairly resistant to high levels of radiation, but not extraordinarily so. There are other insects that aren't quite as appealing, like some stored product pests that are more resistant. But now atomic bombs have gotten so much more powerful that it's not clear any cockroach could survive a contemporary nuclear Holocaust. So that legend that, you know, after an atomic war, the Earth will be populated by cockroaches is not like, oh, maybe Cher. I don't know about Cher. I haven't seen those data. So, but that's another one of those truisms that really probably isn't true.
Would any insect survive? You said that the household storage pests, I guess you mean those little brown mealy bugs type things, those?
Well, there's some of those species of stored, yeah, exactly. Not mealy, well, mealy bugs are something different, but mealworm, relatives of mealworms, basically. But they didn't really have the cachet of the cockroach, so that phrase never caught on.
Okay.
Hard to predict. The one organism that people are betting on to survive is a microbe, a bacterium called Deinococcus radiodurans. And that is, radiodurans is named because it can withstand staggering amounts of radiation. Dino means giant, like dinosaurs. So it's this amazing bacterium that is the hardiest thing on Earth relative to radiation. So odds are good that there will be lots of this giant bacterium. Well, it's not large size, but there's incredibly hardy bacterium around. More complicated life, you know, multicellular life would have a hard time.
You're really educating me. I never thought of cockroaches and cachet together, but I'll look at this in a new way.
All right.
Thank you.
Another great blow for public broadcasting here. let's see. I think not line two. I think we have a caller on line two. Hello?
Yes. Good morning.
Hi.
Got a beetle. It's about a half inch long with a white stripe down its back. A voracious eater of just potatoes, beans, tomatoes. Do you have any idea what it is?
Is it a little bit like a little bit velvety or furry, or is it all shiny?
I think it's kind of overall shiny. I just went out and caught one, so let me see here. Velvety or shiny?
The reason I ask is that
it's kind of a satin sheen.
Yeah. All right. I ask because I think it might be one of the ones that stumped me before that I subsequently... I mean, its broad diet is very odd. Most beetles, in fact, most plant-feeding insects feed on a really narrow range of plants, maybe one or two families of plants. And you named a whole bunch of families. And there's not that many beetles that can do that. Japanese beetles can. They're in a... that's why they're such pests. But there's a group of beetles that are... very so-called polyphagous. They feed on many different plant families that are called the blister beetles. And there are striped blister beetles that do feed on a variety of... Here's one called the striped blister beetle, Epicauda vitata. And it's what colors do you see there? Is it sort of darkish color?
Yeah, it's kind of a charcoal.
Right. Yes, it could well be what's called the margined blister beetle. It has black wings. It's got ash gray, fine margins, and a little bit, it's not shiny and hard, a little bit softer.
Yeah.
And it's a pest of all kinds of garden crops.
Now, the only thing is that I have squished hundreds of them, and I've never gotten any kind of a reaction.
Oh, blister? Well, they don't necessarily... The different blister beetles some of them are incredibly zippy. I mean, when you touch them, they ooze blood through their joints and cause irritation. Others are not quite so potent. So I don't think the margin blister beetle is the one that the ones that really cause problems, there's a species that's all black and shiny called the black blister beetle that occasionally gets into forage like hay and poisons horses and the like. But I don't believe that the margin blister beetle is quite as potent as the black blister beetle. Of course, the most famous of all the blister beetles is what's known as Spanish fly, Lita vesicatoria. That's a European species that is really zippy. So, but those don't occur around here. So that would be my guess.
Okay. Well, thank you.
And I'm glad to get revenge on the blister beetle for having stumped me once before. So maybe it is. It sounds like a margin blister beetle.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to line one for Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Yesterday I was walking down a sidewalk in a dry, sunny area, and I saw some insects scurrying in front of me as I walked, and as I approached, they'd fly a short distance, land.
And look at you?
Scurry, yeah. Mm-hmm. And from my distant past entomology, I thought they might be tiger beetles.
Yep, exactly. That's why that's exactly what they do. They're predators. They're predaceous, and they seem to have this attitude where you're on their turf. So you step down, they fly a little bit, turn and look at you, and you take another step, and they do exactly the same. Shiny, the most common species is a shiny green one. Is that what you were seeing? Or
I think so. I didn't get close enough this time, but in the past I've seen some.
Very fast. They move very quickly. They're really excellent predators. If you got a good look at their faces, you know what might strike fear into the dorsal aorta of any potential prey. They have enormous jaws, and they're called tiger beetles because they are voracious predators. But you described exactly. They love the sun. They are sensitive to light. They have long legs. They can move really quickly. They'll fly short distances, turn around and face you, and do it again. And they're generally considered beneficial because they do eat, just about anything they're fast enough to catch. And since they're very fast, that's a wide range of insect prey.
So do they, could you tell us a little bit about the life cycle? Do they have burrows nearby or something?
The immatures live in the ground. And the adults will actually also dig tunnels to shelter in when it's too hot. And they also will dig in the ground to overwinter. So the eggs live in a little burrow, and the larva has three different stages. The larvae are also predaceous, and they'll hide in their tunnels, and they'll have an opening at the top of the ground and wait for unsuspecting prey to walk by, and they'll reach up, grab them, and drag them into the ground and dispatch them quickly.
Great. I can remember seeing a close-up picture at some point, and they look almost prehistoric or something.
Yeah, they've got your classic insect jaws. I mean, they really are well-equipped for seizing and dismembering things.
Great. Thanks a lot.
All right. We'll try and get one more here. We have a caller in, I believe, in Moments, line number four. Hello.
Hi. Good morning.
Yes.
Two quick questions. A while ago, when one of the callers talked about mantises, and I'm really nuts about mantises myself. I'm just fascinated by them. I like to watch them and hang out with them as much as they will allow it. But finding a mantis is always a happenstance thing. You never know when you're going to find one. So in order to show one to my three-year-old, when he's in the mood to watch it, is there a place where I can go to? Do they have a habitat that they're more likely to be found in than just happen to walk past my garage and see one hanging to the side of the hang up the side of the garage?
Well, that's the tricky thing about predators. Unlike plant feeding insects feed on things that don't move around too much, plants. So they're pretty sedentary themselves. So it's really easy if somebody wants to see a golden tortoise beetle, I can say, go look on your morning glories and turn over the leaves and you'll find them there. The problem with predators is that they're constantly, most predators, unless they feed on aphids or something that aren't too mobile, they're constantly on the move, and they have to forage over a much broader geographic range. So they move around a lot. That said, where I tend to see mantids around here is in sort of abandoned weedy lots. They're called old fields by ecologists that maybe used to be a cornfield that's now overgrown, road edges, in amongst the goldenrod. So I see the egg cases on the goldenrod over the winter, and then during the summer, you see them busy foraging. But it's a tricky business to try to track down a predator. It's like the same thing with big game hunters. There's more prestige, and at least there used to be before people realized what damage they were doing, and bagging something like a tiger than bagging like a deer or a moose or something, which are much more predictable in their movements. So predators in general, big or little, are pretty hard to find.
Well, I'm going to have to jump in. I hope the caller will forgive me. I think you wanted to ask another question, but we've just used our time, and we're going to have to leave it there with our thanks to our guest, Mae Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at University of Illinois. And if you're interested in reading more on insects, you might look for some of her books, including Bugs in the System, Insects and Their Impact on Human Affairs, and also her books 99 Gnats, Nits, and Nibblers and 99 More Maggots, Mites, and Munchers. They're both published by the University of Illinois Press. And if you have kids who are interested in insects, that might be a good book to look for.
No, older kids.
Okay.
The younger kids won't get the bad puns.
Yeah. Well, thanks
very
much.
Maybe some of the older kids, too.
Yeah, we appreciate you being here.
Always a pleasure.